between the end of the Civil War 150 years ago until the height of Jim Crow in the early 20th century, African Americans established more than 50 all-black towns across the state. In 2000, Oklahoma Historical Society Director of Special Projects Larry Odell wrote that African Americans built prosperous farming communities in both the Indian and Oklahoma territories before statehood, and they supported businesses, schools, newspapers, and churches. Today, only a handful of these towns survive, since many failed in the 20s and 30s as the Great Depression forced residents to leave the South in search of jobs. Today on Oklahoma Voices, we'll hear about the history of these towns and the few that remain as part of a panel discussion hosted by the Oklahoma Historical Society in late June. It features a mixture of black town government representatives and scholars, like retired East Central University historian Linda Reese, attorney and author Hannibal Johnson, as well as Grayson Mayor James Anderson, Rennesville Mayor Mildred Burkhalter, and the Town of Langston trustee Alonzo Peterson. The panel discussion was moderated by State Representative George Young.
I want to start our conversation off talking with the four individuals first who represent the black towns. And again, the mics on the end, they're alive, and both mics on the end are alive. Yes, thank you, Brother Johnson, if you hand that to one of our folk. And we'll start with Mr. Anderson, Mayor Anderson, down on the end. The first question we want to do is really not a question, but if you would, give us a little of the history and the background of your hometown.
Say, I'm the mayor of Grayson, Oklahoma, formerly known as Wildcat, established in 1897. And in 1902, the United States established a post office in the town of Wildcat, Oklahoma, and the name was changed to Grayson, Oklahoma. We were established in the Indian Territory, originally in McIntosh County. We're now located in Okmulgee County, Oklahoma. And our population is just 139 individuals in our community, but we are thriving. And I am the mayor, the fire chief. I operate the sewer system. My wife says I do too much, but I love my hometown and I love black history.
Ms. Burkhalter?
I'm Mildred Burkhalter from Rennesville, Oklahoma, first elected in 1991 to present. We had two distinguished individuals that come from our community. If you remember Dr. John Hope Franklin, I'm sure you all do.
Yes.
Have D.C. Minner, who is famous for his blues, and I believe Selby's in the audience somewhere, his wife, yeah, right there, carrying on the blues. Rennesville was founded by four individuals, William Renty, N.H. Bohannon, Reverend N.A. Robinson, and Ism Foster. And one lady by the name of Phoebe McIntosh contributed 40 acres along with William Renty to build Rennesville. Rennesville was founded in 1902, incorporated in 1903. The name took, Rennesville took the name from William Renty because it was known that William Renty didn't have any children, and to carry on his legacy of his name, it was named Renty, therefore adding Ville, calling it Rentisville. In the early 1900s, the population of Rennesville was 800 plus. Now we have a population of 132 individuals. Rennesville back in the early 1900s had mercantile stores, well, one, cotton gin, train depot, there was doctor, grocery stores. The main crop was cotton, potatoes and corn because there was lots of farmers. And one significant thing we have going on in Rennesville right now, lots of credit to the Oklahoma Historical Society, to the Friends of Honey Springs, and Dr. Bob Blackburn, who was here earlier, still in the audience. We have a 5,000 square feet Oklahoma History Center being constructed on the edge of Rennesville. So, and that is in relation to the Battle of Honey Springs. And if you know some history about the Battle of Honey Springs, that's what it will be, you know, contributed to. But that was one of the major civil wars in Oklahoma history. Is that what is most significant about it, and what I appreciate very well, is that on the front line was all Native Americans and African Americans. So, you know, that's one significant part. But anyway, Rennesville had three schools built. Two of them burned down. There's a portion of the old third building still lasting there. So anyway, we're still surviving. We're still hanging on by threads, but we're still there.
This is Miss Hicks, who used to be my chair of my trustee, so she can tell me what to do. She told me to get out the way so she could do it. Like a good pastor, I got out the way, let my chair of trustee have it, yeah.
To Mr. and Mrs. Head, Dr. Blackburn, he told me that, I asked him, how do you call him? What do I call him now that he's a representative? Do I say, Dr. Representative Young? He said, well, since you've been my chair, my member, so long, you could just call me George. But I'd rather call him Pastor. Amen. To all of you here, ladies and gentlemen, it is my joy to see you. And I didn't name Boley the crown jewel of the black towns. Somebody else did. But agree with me, it is. I'd like for everybody from Boley to please stand. I see my cousins over there. I see my cousins over here. And let me just take the time. I know you want to hear a little more about Boley, but, and this is all Boley, it's all good. Let me tell you that the mayor of Boley is here tonight, the present mayor, that's Mrs. Frances Marzette Shelton. Frances is here and she should be in red and black. We're so good that we even brought the old mayor with us. So we're going to ask her to stand. That's Mary Joan Holloway Matthews. And if you notice, we're wearing a little red and a little black because those were our high school colors. And we kind of think that belonged to Boley because we said we are the red and black Boley Bears. And here we are. Here we are. And let me give you just a little bit about Boley. Boley was founded in 1903. You saw all of that on the screen there. But Boley was founded in 1903. And it was founded really because of the railroad. As you heard me say on the screen there, that it needed water because it's old steam railroad. It needed water in those old steam things. So they had to stop every 6 miles. And Peyton is 6 miles from us. Castle is 6 miles from us. The seat of Okefuskee County would be 12 miles from us. So they had to stop somewhere. And that stop was Boley. And that was fertile soil, good for what they called back then Negro settlement. And the two white men were the people that were responsible for the railroad at that time. Of course, there were black men working there. And they sort of put their heads together and decided, well, let's start a town. And they did. That was in 1903. It was opened in 1904. It was incorporated in 1905. So we were here before Oklahoma was a state. Yes. 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 And I can't tell you all of the stuff in a few minutes that I've been allotted, but we've had everything there in Boley that you have in the big cities. We have the town was based on our cultural legacy, and the gentleman that really came to handle the town and planted the town was from Red River in Texas at that time, T.M. Haynes. And by way of advertising, he first started with rodeos and carnivals and inviting people to come to Boley, the land of the free, where you could vote, where you could have a say that you were somebody. And people came by the wagons. They came by the boxcars. They came by tractors. They came by whatever way they could get there. By any means necessary, they came to Boley. And that's why Boley has become what it is. Now, we had, at one time, we had upwards of 7,000 people, and as the population was. The population now is about 500 on a good day. It's about 1,000 on a bad day. And I tell you that. And I tell you that not, it, and it really is, we do enjoy that. We have a prison there. We have a state prison there. And those prisoners are counted as in our census, in our population. Yes. So that's a good thing. But our population really is about 500. And I see that we have Miss Violet Nash sitting there with her red and black on. She is not from Boley, but she thinks she's from Boley, and we think she is too. She's a great soloist. Well, and we had lawyers, doctors, farmers, mercantile people, people of every kind of occupation you can think of. We've had all kinds of schools, and I forgot to mention that I have a sister city here too, and that's Clearview. Where is Shirley? Shirley is here, there she is, Shirley Nero, my sister city. We're very good friends. Boley had lots and lots of people. We had everything that you have in the big cities. We finally got sidewalks, we have street lights, we had honky-tonks, we had houses of irrepute. We had everything in Boley. And time for me to sit down. Okay, he told me.
All right, good evening. It's really unfair to have a Louisiana implant follow a living legend, and it really is. But not to be outdone, I'm from Langston, Oklahoma. I'm a trustee from Langston, Oklahoma, home of the Langston University Lions. So, if you went to Langston, had a child to go to Langston, or a grandchild to go to Langston, stand up. So, thank you very much. I think there's more people than in Boley, right? Like I said, I am an implant. I've only been a trustee in the town of Langston for about 2 years. I'm representing our mayor, Alicia Sumlin, who had been ill for a long time, and so she could not make it. And the history of Langston, many of you know it already, but the history of Langston is that it was founded in 1890 by three men, William Eagleson, Charles Robbins, and Edward McCabe. Edward McCabe was kind of known as the promoter of Langston, and he pushed a lot of wanting more affluent blacks to come to Langston, and because of the pushes that he made is the reason that we have the town and the reason that we have Langston University in the town. At the height, there were about 25 or more businesses in the town of Langston, including anything that you can name. We had the dance hall clubs and the doctors and medical facilities. We had three schools at Langston. Some of these things I didn't know, Dr. Holloway brought me to Langston nine years ago. And he would tell me some of the great stories about Langston. And I was just amazed because coming into Langston now, you don't see all of the businesses and those things. We have maybe six businesses in the town of Langston. But one thing that he did share with me that has been common throughout the history of Langston and probably common throughout the history of most of these black towns is a sense of community. It's a sense of family. And coming into Langston, I was welcome just arms open wide. And I brought my family into Langston. I have five kids. I got a lot of children. So when y'all leave here, tell Dr. Kent Smith that I need a raise because he ain't paying me a whole lot up there. So, but that sense of community is still in Langston. My kids can walk around the town and, we feel safe in the town. It is, our neighbors know each other. We all know each other. I have six families that live on my street. Four families go to the same church. And that's how close the community is. And with the university there, the students are coming back into the town of Langston to help and work and help build the town of Langston. So we are very proud of our relationship with Langston University, and we're proud of the sense of community and family that Langston had and continues to have. So thank you.
Thank you. We did also have with us that was scheduled to be with us, Dr. Samuel R. Craig, who would represent Taft, Oklahoma, but Dr. Craig had eye surgery and could not make it with us. And we also had scheduled with Keisha Gaines Curran of, they say you're supposed to pronounce it Tallahassee, but it's T-U. I said Tallahassee, but I'm not going to get into no problems of Tallahassee, and she could not make it either. So I want to recognize those two individuals. Now what I'd like to do, we have two of our researchers and those we call the historians with us. And first, I'd like to ask them a question. And Dr. Linda Reese, you're first on. My first question to you, and if you would give us a few minutes on this topic, what was life like for the freed slaves in Indian Territory after the Civil War?
Well, first I'd like to say you can't imagine what an honor it is to be with this group of people tonight. I've made new friends and have so enjoyed our time together before we came to this part of the program. In answer to the question, very quickly, I've just recently finished a book in which I delve deeply into the circumstances for the freed people following the Civil War. And it is one of extreme tragedy. I think we cannot truly understand what they went through because we have not experienced war on our own home front, right next to us. And particularly for the freedmen as they came, as they stayed in Indian Territory during the war, because some were left behind. Their masters fled away to the north or south, but some were supposed to stay back and hold down the land, and others who then fled to the north for safety, and others who were forcibly removed from Indian Territory by their masters into Texas, into the south in Texas, and kept down there until the end of the war. But as I said, I wrote a whole book about this, so you're going to have to stop me. But it was the most desperate circumstances that you can imagine. Those who had left Indian Territory now had to struggle back alone, many barefoot, with nothing but a few clothing in a bag, with their children in hand, walking most of the way, coming back from Kansas or up from Texas, or managing to hitch a ride on a wagon with other people coming in this direction. But they were returning to a wasteland, essentially. The war had so destroyed the area where the fighting had taken place. They were coming home, and they were coming home, desperate people, to a wasteland. And it is a tribute to those lives. It is a tribute to those people that they settled in on the lands. They began to grow crops. They built homes. They struggled to form communities. They began to build churches and have church services. They started schools for their youngsters. It is truly a story of heroism and pride and hope and the accomplishments of their labor for that particular period.
Thank you. Mr. Hannibal Johnson, what were the differences? This is a good question because I think you'll see. What were the differences in black towns in Indian Territory and black towns in the Oklahoma Territory, because there was a separation?
That is an excellent question. I would remain seated if that's okay. I just want to say that it's important to think about the trajectory of Oklahoma history in terms of those twin territories, Oklahoma Territory to the west, Indian Territory to the east. Oklahoma became a state November 16th, 1907. And one of the activities, the inaugural activities leading up to statehood, was a ceremonial marriage between a white man who represented Oklahoma Territory and a Native American woman who represented Indian Territory. Where did that leave African Americans? So I think we should think about the symbolism and what that says for the trajectory of race relations going forward in Oklahoma from that point of statehood. more of the black towns on the Indian Territory side are surviving today than on the Oklahoma Territory side. Now, why is that? A lot of the towns that were formed in Indian Territory were formed by people of African descent who were affiliated with the five civilized tribes. So they were what's called freedmen, some of whom had been enslaved by those tribal members, others of whom were free people living among those tribal nations. And so those people got access to land during the allotment process in the early part of the 20th century. Also, in some of the tribes, for example, the Muscogee Creek tribe, there was a system of land ownership that legally is called usufructuary, which means that you were entitled to live on and use the land that you needed, basically, although you did not have clear title to the land. So a lot of the people of African descent living among or affiliated some way with the five civilized tribes gained access to land, and around that land they built these towns. For example, those people who have connections to the Muscogee Creek Nation, Muscogee Creek Nation is kind of a confederation. So there were a lot of tribal towns. Some of those tribal towns were towns populated largely by African Americans. The other thing I want to point out is that there was some tension between people of African descent who had Native American connections and people of African descent who had migrated to Oklahoma from the Deep South to escape the political oppression that existed there. You know how we have sort of petty personality differences and conflicts today? Well, they had those same kinds of conflicts. For example, the natives, those people with Native American ancestry, thought that the people coming from the Deep South were too servile because they had been conditioned to act at the behest of the white man. So there was a conflict over attitudes. The other thing about the towns in Indian Territory is that they were proximate to the headquarters of the various Indian nations, so they had that level and degree of support as well. So generally, those towns on the Indian Territory side fared better. Boley, Clearview, Taft, Grayson, those are towns that are still surviving today. As opposed to some of the towns on the other side, most of whom are no longer in existence, with the notable exception, of course, of Langston, which is on the Oklahoma Territory side.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go back through again and let those individuals representing a town. The next question is, we want those individuals who represent the four towns that we have here to talk about two or three things that they're really proud about that has occurred recently in the life of their town. Two or three things they want to brag about and to put out there that has occurred. But while they're doing that and passing the mic back down to Mayor Anderson, if you have a question, raise your hand. They will bring you a card, and you'll write your question on that card, and they'll give that to me. And if you trust me, if you write plain enough, I'll try to read it. If you trust me, I will. I can only speak English, and I don't do that well, so write legibly. Yeah. Well, we'll start with Langston. Two or three things you really want to brag about. But so we can get, you're doing really well. We're going to have some questions, but two or three things you want to brag about when it comes to Langston.
Well, the center of the town of Langston now, everything kind of is family focused, as I mentioned earlier. Our park has now become the focus and the center of the town of Langston City. Through some grants and some assistance from the university, also HUD, we built a farmer's market as well as a softball field that the university and the town together built, and the Langston University Lions, Lady Lions softball team, that's their home field. As well as we rebuilt the park with a grant from CREC, and we did a community build. And we built playground equipment from the ground up from members of the community as well as Langston University students. And that's one of the instances where I was saying the university students are coming back into the town to assist the town. We probably had over 125 people in the town come out and help build that park and make it a beautiful, beautiful park. So it is the kind of the centralized place of the town right now. The children are happy. It makes for a better community when you have a nice park, a safe park where the kids can go and play. We also have a great relationship with the university, in that the university has assisted us through HUD with also street lighting and sidewalks in the town. Had you come to Langston maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there were barely sidewalks in the town. Now we have a miracle mile, so to speak, down Highway 33. Also, the streets in Langston have gotten really, really good. We've written about 2 years of grants to put new streets in the town. We have about 10 blocks of new streets that have been laid, and another 2 or 3 blocks that are coming on starting next month, as a matter of fact. So we are proud of the progress that we've made in building the park to be the center of the town for family activities.
Thank you.
There are several things that I'm proud of about Boley. And let me just start with one. You can come to Boley, or if you live in Boley, you don't necessarily have to lock your door, lock your car. The other part to that is if something comes up missing, we know who has it.
That's cold.
We're so grateful for so many things for Boley. It really isn't dead. It's quite alive. We do have a waterway that you can fish. I'm not sure that you can ski on there, but there is a big waterway that many of the people are fishing every day. We have a park. We have a walking trail for those of us that need to walk. And we have a nice rodeo arena that we've had for a while, but that has been updated in some respects. We have a very nice, up-to-date fire department. Now, these seem like maybe not big things to you, but to us, they are big things. We have a park there with a pavilion, and that park is named after, I believe, the founder of Boley, one of the founders of Boley. It's called the J.B. Boley Park. I believe that's what it's called. We have one of the few historical museums in the state of Oklahoma in an all-black town. I don't know any other black town that presently have an established historical center, and we do have that. We have a brand new, as the kids used to say, spanking brand new center, public safety facility. And in order for me to explain that to you, you're going to have to come to Boley to see it. It is really very nice. The first time that the judge has had chambers, and I am so glad. It is a very, very nice facility. It's on in the entryway as you come into Boley. We have several businesses that are still in operation. We have several businesses that are not in operation. But we have some that are still in operation. Did you stop me?
Yes. Thank you.
I can tell you a lot more.
Thank you, Ms. Hicks.
Well, one of the great accomplishments of Rennesville was that we were able to keep our zip code. Several years ago, Rennesville post office closed, and we were about to lose the identity of our town. And through help writing letters to our president and other people that was able to help, we were able to gain boxes there in Rennesville that actually has post office box for the residents that wants the boxes. Plus, we're able to hold on to our 74459 zip code. And because if that was eliminated, Rennesville would have lost any little tax base or revenue that we were entitled to because we would have disappeared. But we're still there. We have 2 community buildings. We serve dinners to the elders in the community. It's a place that they can come in fellowship. We do that 4 times a week. another couple of things. We have a community park with a pavilion. It's utilized by people in the town and out of the town. And one great thing is we have a large population of young individuals with families in Rennesville, and that's a part of what is keeping Rennesville alive, and it's growing. We have street names now. We had one street named after Dr. John Hope Franklin in his honor. We have street paved. We have a fire department, like Judge Hicks here said that, you know, it may not seem very much to everyone sitting here, but it means a lot to us. So, like I said, we're still surviving. We're still there.
Well, part of the accomplishments for the town of Grayson, Oklahoma, is we expanded our community center because there, for a while that there were events and family reunions and et cetera taking place, we didn't have enough room. So we added an additional 800 square feet to our community center. And part of that is about fellowship in the community. We have a senior citizen meal program, and to see individuals that normally wouldn't meet, greet, say hello, find out about one another, come together when it's time to serve those meals, and you can walk in and hear the laughter and the joke and see the fellowship, you know, within the community. That I can't explain that feeling that it gives me to be part of that establishment of that program and the building per se itself. And once again, the idea of operating a efficient volunteer fire department, and that's a word that we put in there because we're all volunteers. I mean, our time, our education, the operation of equipment, to obtaining equipment, you know, to be identified as a fire department is really an important thing for our rural communities. Also, we participate with an organization called Eastern Oklahoma Development District. We pay a membership dues, and it's a way of resources for funds through grant programs. And we expanded our sewage system, which was about a $50,000 program, besides expanding our community center, which is about a $45,000 program. So there are programs out there that we participate in. I'm a member of the executive board of the Eastern Oklahoma Development District. And the other thing is we partnered with a company called AtLink, which is a internet communication company. They have a USDA grant from the federal government to bring together towers for communication purposes in rural Oklahoma. And they're building something like, I think it's 37 towers across the state of Oklahoma, because if you hear about, say, dead zones, where you lose your signal, you know, on your telephone and your internet service, this company is building towers around so that those signals can be transferred and be stable. And in that process of selling them property in Grayson, they built a 140-foot tower in Grayson. They assisted us. They donated 5 computers and set up in our community center for a computer system there. And they sent individuals, staff, to train 4 different times so that we could bring individuals in from the community and bring them online with the computers and how to operate those. See, and be part of this global community, which we all are, you know, right now. And I take this opportunity, my nervousness on the front end, our claim to glory is, if you all are familiar with the lady by the name of Miss Clara Looper, see, when she attended grade school and high school, her name was Clara Shepherd, and she was a graduate of Grayson High School. So that's our claim to fame.
All right. Thank you so much. Now, we're running pretty good on time, but I've got some wonderful questions. But I want our two guests who give us the overview. Dr. Reese, I want you to go first. One more question for you, and then one more question for Brother Johnson. But you first, Dr. Reese. What was the process to gaining an allotment of land for Freedman? Dr. Reese?
Well, first of all, I think you should know that in the peace treaties signed by the 5 civilized tribes with the federal government, it was insisted that the 5 tribes incorporate their former slaves as citizens of their tribal groups. And that was one of the demands that they had to acquiesce to. Now, as we well know, there was quite a lot of unpleasantness surrounding that, but that was and still is. Yes, it remains today. Yes, absolutely. But when we moved forward in time toward the process of converting the Indian nations into the state of Oklahoma and the allotment process was begun, then those former enslaved people had a right to an allotment of land. And so, just as the members of the five nations did. And so they would be required then to meet at a specific location, present any kind of documentation that they had, if they had any at all, as to the tribal group that they belonged to, and then register with the government to receive an allotment of land. Now, this works sometimes, and sometimes it didn't work. And so there were many cases of contested people receiving lands. Part of that had to do with the fact that once allotment became known to the rest of the United States, you had a flood of African Americans coming in from the South who saw this was a pretty great deal to get land in Oklahoma. And so there was a great deal of contested allottees. Some never did get their claim. Some did get their claims, and then as we well know, if we travel down just a few years later, when they struck oil, some people either lost it, or if they managed to hold on to it, managed to reap the benefit of those lands.
Thank you. Mr. Hannibal Johnson, this is a good question to transition from Dr. Reese's question. We've talked about E.P. McCabe. Talk about his efforts to recruit African Americans to Oklahoma, and what was the benefit? What was the selling point to get those to come? I think we've heard some of that already, but talk to us about that.
I think of E.P. McCabe as the father of the all-black town movement. He was a New Yorker who moved to the all-black town of Nicodemus, Kansas, which is in northwest Kansas. He became the state auditor in Kansas, the highest elected black official in the state in 1882 and 1884. He came to Oklahoma during the land run, April 22nd, 1889, and he founded Langston, as we've heard before. He also helped found a number of the other all-black towns in Oklahoma, and he was appointed territorial auditor in Oklahoma Territory by the United States President Benjamin Harrison. So McCabe actually floated this idea before the United States President, Benjamin Harrison, of creating or carving out an all-black state within the Oklahoma Territory. The president actually took that conversation quite seriously and really entertained it, mulled it over for a while. Obviously, it didn't quite pan out that way. But in its stead, we have all these all-black towns in Oklahoma, more black towns than any other state in the United States. Historically, we have more than 50 black towns created within the two territories of what is today Oklahoma. Now, why were people interested in coming to Oklahoma in the first place? Well, after Reconstruction, which collapsed in 1877 with the removal of federal troops, there was really retrenchment on racial relations in the Deep South, political oppression, lack of economic opportunity, and Oklahoma was a territory, not a state, and people of African descent thought Oklahoma was a place where there would be economic opportunity, there would be an escape from the political oppression that black people faced in the South. It was just opportunity and hope. That was really what it was all about. And the third element was propaganda. People like E.P. McCabe were propagandists, not in a really negative sense, but they were propagandists in the sense they were promoting or touting Oklahoma as a place where black people ought to resettle. And McCabe developed bulletins, written materials that he sent down south. He also hired agents. He literally hired people to go down south and recruit. I use one of his bulletins in one of my books, and it says, essentially, what will you be if you stay in the South? Slaves liable to be killed and never treated right. But if you come to Oklahoma, you have equal chances with the white man, free and independent. So there's this great mindset about independence and freedom. And the other thing that's in the ether during this period is the Booker T. Washington philosophy of proving oneself to the white man, and therefore the kind of racism that exists against us will go away. It will subside. It will abate. So the idea of creating your own enclaves, showing your worthiness, your industriousness, your ability to be self-sufficient, that would go some way, Washington thought, and other thinkers like him thought, that would go some way toward eliminating or at least lessening the kind of racism that people faced.
Thank you. If you've been listening, you're probably looking at me and thinking, he sure is smart. They're just making me look smart. It's not me, really. It's really good. Yeah. Quickly, because my time is running out, whoever wanted to answer this question, but I've got two questions along the same line addressed to the black towns. And the question is from one person, almost poses the same question, a native of Boley, Oklahoma. What can we as natives do to back our towns, to encourage our citizens to renew their vigor, to remain strong? And then the other question is, people who are from cities other than the black towns, Oklahoma City and Tulsa, what can you ask them to do to help to encourage those towns that we consider historically black? So any of you who would like to answer that question would be great.
Let me just quickly say, I think what you can ask me as a Tulsan to do is to come to your black town and leave some money when I leave.
So, one of the things that we need in Langston is business. When E.B. McKay invited all of those families into Langston originally, he brought in businessmen. And the town thrived. We need businesses in Langston. We need not only African American, but we need all people to, someone to come and make a serious investment in the town. A store. We've actually been in talks with Walmart to bring a neighborhood Walmart, but they're very difficult to get into a small town. I mean, like as small as ours. So we need people who have a vision, who have some resources or some connections to come and put a business in Langston that we can generate tax revenue, that we could continue to build the town. Without the tax base, without the tax revenues, it's very, very difficult for the towns to survive. Yeah. And so without those things, more and more black towns and small towns in general will, you'll see, die away.
You don't want to add any more to that? Interesting.
No, I don't need to add not one iota to that, with the exception of, yes, I do believe you need to do that too. Now, as far as Boley goes, it would be very helpful though for those landlord people that own property there, if you would do nothing more than cut your grass. That would help. If you will come and cut your grass, that will really help. Now, as he said, and I certainly agree, and I think all of us agree with that, that we need businesses. Businesses will keep us alive. We don't have schools anymore. People think that as your schools go, so will your town. But that's not true. Our towns are still alive, and we don't have schools anymore. So if you want to see us stay alive, if you want to see the towns that are here and the towns that you have heard us talk about, if you want to see us stay alive and be who we really are, come on and help us. Tours will be very nice. If you come on a tour, bring some money. Spend it. If you know of a business that wants to come to any of the three towns, bring them in there. Four towns, five towns. Whatever you can do to help, we would be very appreciative. We're not begging, and we're not greedy, but we just need your help.
Well, thank you.
You know, what I wanted to add is, like in Rennesville, you know, the land that is in the town limits, you might have one block. There's 10 lots in that block. but they may be owned by 10 individuals. And what has happened, a lot of the landowners are deceased. It may have went to an heir, but those heirs have not changed the land over into their name. So it's just kind of like, if you want to build something there, you got to find these 10 individuals, and it may be 15 offsprings from that you have to deal with. So that is kind of like a tie up in Rennesville. But you know, one thing is that she was talking about the grass cutting. We have that problem in Rennesville. And one thing I see is we have people come back on Memorial Weekend. They come back for family reunions and they use our center. But then sometimes they forget about the roots from where they came from. You know, and if they appreciate the history that their family have left there, then all I ask is that they come back and do something for Rennesville. Keep your land cleaned up, you know, beautify Rennesville, make it look like it's a town or whatever else, but we sometimes forget when we move away and we forget about where our history came from.
So just to follow up on that same bit of information is about maintaining our towns, and we don't think too much about people cutting their grass and cutting down old dead trees and trash being removed, those kind of things. But the majority of people in these small black towns that see these things happen, they volunteer their own time. You know, so if you have relatives that own property, you know, and those kind of things, if you just want to do it even on Memorial Day weekend, you know, can you send a donation of some kind, you know, for that kind of upkeep? And like now, as I mentioned before, we are global now. One of the things that we're looking into in Grayson is generating an alumni list to try to contact individuals. So when we do have our local fundraisers, some of you may be familiar with, the only one I'm familiar with is it's a program called PayPal. And now, who's not banking or doing some kind of financial transaction on your cell phone or on your computer kind of a thing? So when you hear from your small towns and find out that they're doing a fundraiser, if they have those kind of programs set up, you know, can you click a dollar? Can you click $5? Yes, you know, to help out so that they can handle it. Because we have to do the same thing. If we're incorporated, we have to have workers' comp insurance. We have to have liability insurance. We have to pay our property insurance. You know, those things are by law. You know, if we want to stay as an incorporated town, you have to abide by those rules. And those things cost money. And most of the grants that we get, they're not 100% grants. Say, for instance, Grayson would like to buy some property, you know, for, say, $80,000. Well, we can't really afford it, you know, right now. But if we could get a grant, and a grant would be, say, what they call 80-20, if we had $20,000, we could get $80,000 with the grant. Now we can purchase a property to put together us a business. See, so it's a partnership thing. So a dollar adds up, you know, if you put them together. And I don't just tell my kids, you have to start out counting from one. You can't go start at 100. You always have to start at one to get to 100. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, there's a couple of questions I can combine, and this I may be able to answer this myself. Both questions are about tourism, black towns. One of the statements in the question was, I want to take my wife and my children, we want to visit all of the black towns. So I don't know if that's a question. They said, how do we contact the representatives? And the other question was, how can we utilize our black towns for Oklahoma tourism? I don't know if we got that contact information in the books, but you'll take care of that later. Okay, then. So that's one of the questions that people want to do, I think, come and visit all the black towns. The other question I thought was really good, a couple of questions that came together, was about education. What do you think is the most important lesson our young students can learn by studying the history of Oklahoma black towns? Is the history of black towns being taught well in Oklahoma schools?
I can assure you that the
I'm just asking a question. Don't shoot me. All I'm doing is reading off the question. Don't be booing me. That's all I'm doing. Listen, that's all. So give me an answer. Don't boo me. Give me an answer.
The history of black towns is not being taught at all in the school system. So, I mean, the history of black towns, just like the history of African Americans, has to be taught in the home and in the churches. You know, obviously, you know, my children think Martin Luther King is an old historical figure. They don't realize how dynamic he was, how he changed the face of America. And so he's just another page in a history book to my children. So we have to take great effort to teach them about all of the great men and women of color in America, as well as the great men and women of color throughout our local towns, our black towns, and the impact that they made.
I just want to add one little piece to that, and that is, in terms of history, I am an integrationist, which is to say that I think the history of the black towns, the history of the 1920 Tulsa race riot, that's American history. It's not just black history, and everybody needs to know about it. So it needs to be part of the regular curriculum. Yes, we can teach it at home. Yes, we can teach it in churches, but we need to insist that it be taught as part of the regular curriculum.
Anybody else have a remark, response to that? Okay, let me add this, Dr. Blackburn, since you're here and I'm here, what we can do is I would ask you to help me. I know there's something on the books and the statutes about teaching cultural history in our books. If you help me put together the bill, we'll put that before the state legislators and make it mandatory that we teach this particular information about black towns. So, I think this may be a quick answer. Is it true that Wewoka was the first black settlement in Indian Territory, began in 1849 by black Seminole John Horse, a.k.a. Gopher John, who fled to Mexico shortly thereafter? Anybody verify that?
I don't know, but I think so.
Thanks.
I think Wewoka was. Clearview came along a little after that.
But Tallahassee comes, or Tallahassee, depending on how you pronounce it.
Yeah, don't be messing with Tallahassee.
Comes along in 1850, so that's like a year later, right? So,
yeah. Another quick question. Nicodemus, Kansas, you mentioned that a few minutes ago, is the only surviving, this question, I can't verify this, the only surviving black town that was settled by exodusters. I haven't heard that term yet. What percentage of Negro freedmen were exodusters, or were they all exodusters in Oklahoma?
Okay, the term exodusters refers to black folks who were migrating out of the Deep South after the collapse of Reconstruction in 1877. So there would be a difference between those people who are classified as exodusters, the migrants from the Deep South, and the freedmen, as we know the term freedmen here in Oklahoma. Freedmen are people of African ancestry who lived among the five civilized tribes, either as enslaved persons or free persons.
Ms. Hicks, I think this is probably a question for you. Explain the difference. Nobody will get this but folk from Boley. Explain the association between Boley and IXL.
Boley has been a town since 1903 Indian Territory, as you heard me say, and then you saw it on the film. IXL was a community outside of Boley. IXL has now become a town with its own mayor, And I guess a part of what people want me to say is that Dr. Ernest L. Holloway came out of IXL by way of Boley.
Okay. We got a few people.
Our parents and grandparents, his parents, my parents, were all in Boley. And of course, they had to move to different areas for farming purposes, and they went to IXL. But he still came to Boley High School. He finished Boley High School, and he taught Boley High School, and he became, as you well know, an illustrious president. And he has some cousins here, and he has some sisters here, too, tonight. And while I have the mic, there are other great people that have come from Boley. Some of you might not know, the first African-American that played for the Boston Red Sox came from Boley. He may have some relatives here. Pumpsy Green. I don't know if he has relatives here or not, but Pumpsy Green was the first African-American to play for the Boston Red Sox. And then there was Cordell Camper, who played for the Cleveland Indians. Now, we have many, many notable people. As a matter of fact, the first female superintendent of a school came from Boley. And she was superintendent in Boley. That's Velma Doff and Ashley. Everybody remember her. You know, we couldn't stand her. But that was... But she was some fine superintendent, believe me. She was. She put Boley schools on the map, and we were some of the, well, some of us were the, some of the best students in the country. We would give Douglas High School here in Oklahoma a fit, because we were just that good. You shouldn't have let me talk.
Yes, Ms. Hicks. Miss Ashley also graduated from Spelman, and she cooked some of the best biscuits in the world.
Yeah. And the church over there that Dr. Young was speaking of, I brought pictures of the church with me. If anybody wants them, they're on a postal card. If anybody want one, let me know. I also have some rodeo books. If anybody wants to see one of those, they were last year's, but I still have some. Boley is still a place that you need to come to see if you have not been. And I just have to say this, and most of you know that I worked in Oklahoma City for about 19 years. And I looked over and saw my boss. I bet he says she's still talking. That's Leonard Benton. Leonard is sitting right over there.
Thank you, Ms. Hicks. Get the mic. My time is just about up. There's one other question here before they give me a moment to wrap up, and that is, Brother Hannibal, it may be for you. Mention was made of black towns no longer in existence, and somebody just wanted to name just a few of those that once were in existence that don't exist anymore. Do you know any off the top of your head?
Booker T.
Oh.
Tatum.
Canadian.
Tatum exists.
Yeah. Yeah. My mistake.
Mayberry.
Okay. There's one named OK.
No.
Yeah, there was an OK. OK, there was,
Canadian
Cone. There were about 40, and now there are just 13, and all of us are incorporated.
Gibson Station.
Well, my time is up. What a wonderful, let's give them a round of applause. What a wonderful. Yes, they deserve it. Oh, this is wonderful. What a history. Wonderful. Before I call up Mr. and Mrs. Head again, there's two things that I just want to finish up my time with. One, I think I've already asked Dr. Blackburn to join me in putting together a bill for the next session that will be mandatory that we teach the history of our black towns in all of our public schools in the state of Oklahoma. The other thing I can ask of you to help me with, all of you here, you seem like you're excited. Listen, last week I was out in my district at the Native American Cultural Center. They got it up, they turned it over to the city, trying to work through all of that. That's fine and dandy. I see what they're doing with that, and I'm excited about it. I was out there supporting them. We need an African American Cultural Center. And we need to start talking about it and start moving along those lines. All of this history that you've heard about tonight ought to be in a place where we can go to it and see it after we visit all of these black towns. Thank you. God bless you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion hosted by the Oklahoma Historical Society called Black Towns Then, Black Towns Now. It focused on Oklahoma's African-American communities that thrived between 1865 and the 1930s, as well as a handful of black towns that still exist today. We had to edit portions of this conversation in order to run in the time allotted, but you can hear the entire unedited presentation or watch video of this lively discussion on our website, kgou.org. The views and opinions expressed this hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU staff and management or the University of Oklahoma's Board of Regents who hold our broadcast license. Coming up next is WBUR and NPR's Here and Now with national and local news headlines. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hardzinski.